All right, let me kick it off. So, welcome back to the Gregory and Paul Show. I'm Gregory.
I'm Paul.
And we go live every Thursday, 11 a.m. Pacific time. What time is it for you?
It's 2 p.m. Eastern.
East Coast. We always break down the latest SaaS, startups, AI. We love to talk about whatever everyone is arguing with over on. I'm stumbling through my words today. What everyone's arguing about on X. We have a meeting every Wednesday night to decide on topics for the show.
That's right.
Paul,
that's right.
We've got a great show today. You ready to run down the topics?
So many good topics today.
Okay, let me do it. Okay, so number one, we're going to talk about the SpaceX IPO. I wanted to take over the entire show and talk about this. I've listened to like every podcast out there. I went through the S1 myself with AI. I read a bunch of blogs. A guy I love, Om Malik, that many probably don't know who he is anymore. He used to run a blog called Giga Om, wrote a bunch of great stuff about the SpaceX IPO. So we'll dive into that. We're going to talk about Sam and Dario walking back their AI job apocalypse predictions, maybe because they're planning on going IPO.
Going IPO? As well. Or their investors are telling them to shut it.
Maybe get the heat on X. Yeah, perhaps. You found this really interesting research from Eli Lilly that perhaps they have solved high cholesterol. Sure. Maybe.
Yeah. LDL cholesterol, potentially. LDL.
Yes. We'll dive into the enhanced games. Maybe not so enhanced after all. I was very excited to watch all of that. I have a lot of opinions on the enhanced games. We'll talk about the Vatican weighing in on AI. We got some Rick Rubin updates. We'll touch on the end, perhaps, of the AI token.
Vibe coding.
Token maxing. Era. And of course, I want to end with some really interesting data on Berkeley University, the home of the number one most funded startup school in America, or I guess in the world. We'll dive into it. Paul, so SpaceX IPO.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
What do you think about?
So for maybe you can dive into a little bit. What is happening? What is special about their IPO?
Okay, let me kick this off. So for those who are living under a rock and don't have X and aren't in the news, you might have heard of a company, maybe not, called SpaceX. They are valued or seeking a valuation of $1.7 trillion, making it the largest.
Crazy.
The largest IPO ever in American history. Do you know how large the Apple IPO was, which was the largest of its type back in the 80s when they went public?
Apple.
100 million.
They raised 100 million? Wow.
This thing is like bananas bigger, right? They're looking, so they have, so this is important because I've seen a lot of debates about this on X and people are confused. The valuation is $1.7 trillion, but they're not going to just dump all that stock on the stock market on the opening day. They're looking to raise around $75 billion, which is an enormous amount relative to the $100 million dollars that Apple tried to raise. Yeah. So they're trying to raise $75 billion. A big portion of it's going to come from index funds, right? Any mutual fund, index funds, they'll be forced to buy this because it looks like it's going to enter into the NASDAQ 100. But a big portion of it will be available for retail. I heard it'll be the largest portion ever allocated for retail, up to 30% of all the stock, which is interesting. So this is what's so fascinating about this is like it gets spun in either direction. There's people saying like, hey, they're going to allocate all the stock for retail. It's awesome. Every retail investor can get in on this. And there's other people saying like, they can't secure enough financing or shares allocated for the IPO. They have to dump it all on retail. It's going to make the stock price crazy volatile. It's so interesting. Like every data point on the SpaceX IPO, you can argue like one direction or the other. And it's been fascinating to read about that and see what people are saying regarding it.
And also a question here. They filed. Do you think they'll go IPO this year?
It's supposed to be
What's the timeline?
Imminent in the next couple of weeks.
Okay, gotcha. And then this is stacked on top of other companies like OpenAI and Anthropic this year. Is that correct?
Right. That's where like a lot of the debate has come, was like, wow, there's a lot of companies going public. Like, is there going to be enough money out there to buy up all these shares?
That's right. Yeah. So I've got a stat here that says if you combine the IPO or the hypothetical IPO of SpaceX, OpenAI, Anthropic, the three of them are raising more money than the entire dot-com bubble from 95 to 2000.
I believe that.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, well, do you, those numbers are the,
These
I mean,
numbers are insane.
well, I personally think, I mean, we won't get too far into the Federal Banking Reserve conspiracy corner, but I think it points to inflation. Amazon raised 55 million. Like the numbers were just much smaller. And this, the only thing I'm gonna say about inflation, if you believe there's massive inflation that the Federal Reserve Bank and the BLS are not tracking, it should show up in stock prices. And I personally believe that this proves without a doubt there's enormous amounts of inflation. If you look at like the numbers relative to what the stock market and IPOs were valued at 20 years ago. Anyway, they're raising a ton of money. It's not clear where it's all going to come from.
Yeah,
So
crazy.
does that mean that like these stock prices like crash? Like, should investors get in, retail investors get in on it? Like, given that there's not enough, there's like some question regarding can they raise the money? Like, what do you think
That's right,
that
yeah.
means?
So I don't know about OpenAI Anthropic, but their revenue numbers are crazy,
Yes.
right? So SpaceX,
Correct.
I think the valuation for SpaceX hinges on is Starlink's revenue, which right now is about $12 million, I think, the last time I checked.
12 billion,
That's a
yeah.
lot.
All right, so I've got all the SpaceX numbers in front of me
Yeah,
because
do
I
it.
was so excited about this stuff. Look, on the other hand, I don't think I'm going to buy the stock, but I am
Interesting.
a giant fan of this company. I think what they're doing is incredible. I love the fact that Elon gets a bonus if he establish. I can't believe this is actually in the S-1. If he establishes a permanent, the way it's worded, permanent human colony on Mars with at least 1 million inhabitants, he will get some massive, what is it? 1 billion shares. Like, it's worth billions and billions of dollars. They have to hit a 7.5 trillion valuation, which I don't think is crazy at all. I think that's actually quite doable over a long period. But the colony on Mars is wild. I can't believe that's in the
Yeah,
S-1.
I think that's just pure marketing. 100% pure marketing.
It got me excited.
So on that front, I subscribe to Neil deGrasse Tyson's thought where we will not do anything that's not incentivized. So like there is absolutely zero incentive for us to go to Mars.
Yeah,
I
we
think
talked
that
about this.
we talked about this, right? So there's no money in going to Mars. Who's going to pay for a $1 trillion project that takes 3 years to go to another planet with zero benefits?
Right. So the
Or at
haters
least
say, yeah.
currently we have zero understanding of why we need to go to Mars. Besides what Elon has been saying, that we need to be interplanetary, we need to have a backup plan.
It's a fascinating question. I mean, SpaceX was kind of built on the premise that no one really understood what the business model was anyway, right? And they solved it. Yeah, I know, it's a crazy idea, right? Like, well, okay, so let's break down like the business units. I think this is the other part that I wasn't actually aware of until I ran into this. Like, there's three distinct business units to SpaceX. There's the rocket company, which everyone's familiar with. So that's like $4 billion in
Correct.
revenue. There's what they call connectivity. So that is Starlink. And that is actually a really good business. It's almost $12 million, $12 billion, right? And like, they perhaps are going to put all of the mobile networks out of business. They're going to offer like a superior solution to connectivity in general, which is an incredible product, right? All the airlines have signed up for it. There's
Yes.
maritime. It's a great
That
product.
business I believe in. I
It's a
am a
great
star
business.
100%. I use Starlink. They're great.
And they couldn't have done it without SpaceX. They needed the rocket platform in order to get the satellites in orbit. And what, there's 10,000 satellites orbiting with Starlink today.
It's crazy. Yeah, you can visibly see them.
It's insane. That's insane. Like, there's not even like 10,000 rockets launched in other countries. Like, the numbers are just, okay, so I got connectivity. And then there's the AI business,
which is XAI.
Just over $3 billion today, which also looks like it could grow enormously because, like, they have some relationship with Cursor, their aquarium. They're not, it's kind of, I don't know exactly where they're at with that. They're licensing Colossus to Anthropic. So they're competing directly with AWS and Google Cloud, right, on the services side. So they could see enormous growth on the AI business, which is a great business. So between connectivity and the AI
business, Rocketry
makes a ton of money, right? It's a great company. And they're going to do a whole bunch of other really interesting stuff, right? So wait, what is it here? So, okay, this is good. The total addressable market, their TAM that they put in the S1 is $28.5 trillion, which is more than US GDP. I love it. I think it's hilarious. Okay. And so
they're going to run out of money. First of all, they're going to run out of money for people to buy.
We're just going to print more. That's what we have the Federal Reserve Bank for. Print more. That's how this works. We just make it out of thin air.
Yeah. Just invent the dollars out.
Okay. So they're going to, how do they get there? Because they include all of these crazy adjacent businesses like space tourism, asteroid mining, data centers in space, manufacturing on the moon. So
space tourism.
I think the space tourism business on Mars is going to be huge. Like, if I can go there, I would like to.
Would you go to Mars?
Yeah.
You would?
Yeah.
I would.
It'll be like what? Like, I don't know.
It's a 2-year trip. It's a 2-year trip.
I'll be old at that point. Like, yeah, I'm just going to do it. Like, what do I have to lose at that point? Like, just go for it.
I suppose nothing.
I mean, right? You're like, I've already had a great life. Things have been great. Like, do I want to go to Mars? Like, maybe I'll just look at it and be like, I don't really need that in my life. I don't know. It might be really uncomfortable. I wouldn't like that part. Okay, what else?
Okay, so in summary, do you think it will be a good IPO? What is the biggest thing that people should pay attention to before?
Okay, wait, there are a couple of facts This one's good. They compete with everybody in Silicon Valley. I liked this part because they actually listed, they actually have two competitor section because they have to do it by like business unit. So they name in the S1, OpenAI is a competitor, Anthropic is a competitor, Google is a competitor, Meta as a competitor, Microsoft as a competitor, Threads as a competitor, Reddit as a competitor, TikTok as a competitor, CoreWeave as a competitor. Every hyperscaler just generically is also listed hyperscalers as competitors. I thought that part was amazing, right? Like, he basically listed every possible company in Silicon Valley. And then they have an aerospace section where they name like French aerospace companies I never heard of, like all kinds of crazy stuff. This thing is crazy entertaining. Like, if you want to go through the S1, just go like look it up. It's online and you can get your little AI bot to just ask it questions. It's fascinating. It's really fun. All right.
So basically, Elon's competing with everyone.
With everybody.
Either this company is going to blow up completely or it's going to become the biggest corporation in the history of human race. Is that what you're alluding to?
So, okay, great. So what does this mean for us? Like, I will not buy the stock on the opening day. I don't think buying stock on IPOs as a retail investor is a good idea in general. I wouldn't do it with this one. I think the valuation is really high. Like, yeah, they have a target of $7.5 trillion at some point in the future. So theoretically, if you bought it at whatever they go public at, 1.5, you still could like increase your money by 6 times maybe, but there's going to be a lot of volatility along the way. And there's no
guarantee
that ever happens. So that's why I'd be really skeptical.
I agree.
And there's like lockup periods. There's a lot of people that want to sell. So it's a hard call though. I don't know. There might be a lot of people who just say they want it. They want
100%. Also, like right now, Elon's in favor of the government. They're buddies, but this has like antitrust all over.
Or regulatory.
Or regulatory.
Right? They just might pass some laws, right? Like, there's just a lot going on, yeah.
So, I don't know, man. This is like a lot of risks to it. The business, while profitable, it's uncertain if there's growth potential. The space internet, space or Starlink as a business, I believe in. I'm a real product user. Everything else is just marketing.
I guess the bottom line for me is like, I wouldn't buy an IPO. I think there'll be a lot of selling pressure. Most lockups, they take 3, 6, 9 months. At that point, if you want to be in a stock, it might be worth like buying some. There's this wild card too, like what happens with Tesla. And Tesla I looked the other day because I was like, okay, my theory would have been Tesla will sell off. All the fanboys are going to sell Tesla and they're going to buy SpaceX. And that hasn't happened. So I don't know, that part is so the simplest way to frame this for me is like, I don't have any edge on this stock. I have no idea like how it's going to play out. It could go up, it could go down. It's just in the Warren Buffett too hard pile, right? I think it's a super interesting company.
Don't understand the business.
I think they're executing extremely well. And I think they're going to be a major player in the future. I think it's really, really exciting. Whether it's a great investment or not, I think it's like a total separate question. And I'm out. How's that?
I think that's a good summary. Shall we move on? Let's do it. What's next? Sam Altman and Amodai walks back on AI job apocalypse. What are these two saying now? If they're not so saying AI's going to take
an interview that they had done, I want to say like somewhere outside the country. I thought it was like with the Bank of New Zealand or something. So they're just starting to walk back a lot of their AI job apocalypse talk. Sam even like admitted he was like wrong. I think at a high level, I think this is good. I think it's positive that they're walking this back, because I always didn't believe them and always was against like them saying these things, because like I didn't think they were true. And I think they created a lot of frustration and animosity out there. You know, like I couldn't help but like be really critical of Sam when he said, I looked it up the other day. It was 2 years ago. 95% of what creative people do in marketing agencies is going to be automated by AI, which at the time of reading that, thinking it was the most laughable thing I had ever heard. And it's clearly like not happening. So I'm glad that they've changed their tune at a high level. That's my take on this.
Yeah, this like also ties to what Uber CEO came out and said this week, how they blew through all of their AI token, they're looking at their AI cost and trying to figure out justifying why they're spending $1 million a year on
token. Yeah, we have that. We have that on our list. So like, yeah, the Uber, a couple of people come out and said this, right? That they've blown through their token budgets.
Exactly. So, you know, this whole entire thing about AI, you can just spend more and more on token replacing your existing job force. I think that's kind of, I don't think that's true anymore. I do wonder if what their next sales pitch is. Like, what's next? What's their messaging after AI is going to take all of the jobs?
It's interesting. Do you have any... So theoretically, token costs should eventually come down and make AI a lot cheaper. If they build out all these data centers, there'll be a glut of like data centers.
Yeah.
And the token costs will come down. So that's one thing that I think is inevitable, like long term. So I don't know how long the like constraint around this lasts, and it's expensive today, but will it be in the future? Probably not. I think model routing will also change some of the dynamics. So I posted this the other day on Twitter, because people were just saying like Microsoft gave up on AI and they're banning it. And it was not true. What's happened at Microsoft, they've moved to their own internal tools. They moved off of Claude, and their own internal tools, I think it's like GitHub Copilot, Microsoft Copilot, have some form of model routing, and Microsoft's using model routing, like using different models for different tasks to lower costs, right?
I saw that, right? Use a cheaper model to do dumber things, use an expensive model to do smarter things. That is optimization.
Yeah, and I think it's really obvious that a lot of optimization will happen going forward. So I think on the, I guess the highest level, like on the cost side of AI, I think it's like a very short-term issue. But it's a real issue, like for the next year or two. It's not like it's just going to go away in a week.
Right.
But people will find ways to optimize and reduce the cost. And I think the cost will come down dramatically. So I think that like there's that side of the equation. What I found like more, let's use a word like curious, in what the CTO of Uber said was that he couldn't put a direct link to like revenue. Like maybe there's more productivity, but like the measures they're all using for these things is just like how much AI do you use, not like what is the impact that AI is having.
Correct. So the next phase will be measuring token usage by outcomes, whether you're saving money or you're growing revenue. There's a complete missing layer where you have no idea. All you know is that you're vibe spending tokens and then you're hypothetically creating more things. But even that is falling over a little bit, as in we don't actually know if we're being more productive. So that's going to be a very interesting.
We've talked a lot about this like on our own work, that like it's not clear there's immediate ROI from AI in every use case. And
correct.
And like I keep saying that, like, look, I can definitely write tweets that are bangers and go viral, and I have confidence I can do it in a fairly repeatable way. I have no confidence AI can do that. So yes, AI could write tweets and write content. No confidence that it can write them and make them successful. I think that's like a very nuanced, that's definitely the art side of marketing, right? But can it write average content that is as good as the average of any writer, including myself? Like I believe that might be true. You could probably prove it. And so is there ROI there? Maybe, you know, I have a lot of questions, but like, I think these are the things that like we're going to hash out over the next year or so. And then like you and I also have identified that like if AI increases volume in general, performance goes down. So there's so much like email getting sent now. It doesn't seem to have much of an impact at all anymore. And that wasn't the assumption.
The gap closes.
Yeah. So
the gap closes.
I think that that's another outcome that people haven't really like factored in.
Yeah. There's a lot of different outcomes, but there's a lot of different factors for extending to what we just said. These foundational models has zero incentive to help people figure that out if they're using tokens effectively. It goes against their business model. They want you to spend more on a token.
So here's another thing, like, so I'm using AI to evaluate the SpaceX X1, and like everything AI, I drop it in there and it gives me all these answers. I'm like, this is so brilliant. And then I say, what page is this on? And it's like page 47. So I go to page 47 and I read it, and I'm like, that's not what it says on page 47. That is the part that concerns me the most with AI.
Right.
It's like, this isn't like every once in a while. This is my experience. Every damn time I use AI and I double check it,
correct.
Tons of things are wrong. Completely hallucinated, did the math incorrectly, just bad, like really bad. And it makes me concerned because like, how much are people leaning on this stuff and how much are people doing error checking?
Well, totally a lot.
And do you save anything ultimately if that's what's required, is like this extreme level of...
Yes.
So the Beehive MCP survey we talked about last time too is fascinating because like I know that data set intimately because I created it. So if you didn't create that data or know it intimately, you don't even have the information to ask the right questions.
If you don't know what question to ask AI, you're not going to get any value out of AI. I think that's the future. People have to know what questions to ask in the first place, and I have a general sense if the answer is correct. If you don't have either, AI is not a...
Okay, I'll give you a really specific example. When it surfaced from the S1 that these were the people that SpaceX was competing with. I'm like, oh, that's really funny detail. And so I selected the people that, the companies at it that it named. But I said like, are you sure these are the companies? Can you tell me specifically? And it changed the companies. I'm like, what? What page is on? And I went to the page and like it had like companies that weren't listed. Like I was like, oh my God, dude, this is really bad. Like it needs to be exactly what are listed there. And AI didn't tell me. I only found this because I read the S1 that there's multiple sections on competitors by business unit. So like the aerospace lists different, you know, in the rocket section, lists different competitors than the like internet section, which is obvious, but it didn't tell me that.
Yeah. So you can basically cannot trust it at all.
I don't know. Yes, correct. Like you have to do error checking and check it. And I continue to be surprised by like how many mistakes it makes and how much it hallucinates.
All right, let's move on.
Okay.
Arc. So this one is really interesting to me. I'm a really big proponent of gene therapy and drug development. So this news item says Eli Lilly has created a semi-permanent gene therapy for LDL cholesterol. So with a very massive asterisk. It's not used to as a permanent cure. We don't actually know if that's the case yet. Mm-hmm. You basically will have to take it permanently, essentially, to overall reduce all of your risks to it. Basically, the implication is that we're creating drugs now that are actually fixing a lot of these issues that we face every single day, like high cholesterol, like heart disease. So I'm super bullish in what this all means. Maybe in 50 years, we could, for the first time, cure a lot of these diseases.
I mean, look, dude, I'll sign up. Like I have high cholesterol that's genetic. Like everyone knows, like I'm really fit. I'm like vegan. Like I eat really well, but I just have a genetic predisposition to create more cholesterol than I should. So like I'm all for it. I sign me up for this gene therapy. It's interesting. They say it's not permanent, or they're not sure it's permanent because they just haven't tested it to see if it's actually permanent.
Correct. So like it's still early stages, right? So either if you get the dose wrong, or if you're stop taking the pills, the outcome could be also permanent. So like there's a lot of wiggle room in the middle to say if the pill works for everyone or not. So the future of these like pills will likely be extremely personalized. It will be very boutique. It's going to be designed just for you. I don't think we have the technology to do that on a mass scale yet, but the future will be curable of permanent boutique created individualized drugs.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I actually, I think this is a really good segue into the enhanced games.
Yeah.
Like speaking of drug therapies and personalized drug therapies. So for people that weren't paying attention, Peter Thiel, I read Donald Trump too put up some money for this. I don't know if that's true actually. They did what they called the enhanced games, where they did an Olympic style competition in Las Vegas over the weekend, and they allowed all the athletes to just take performance enhancing drugs, and they had rules around it. They were like they're monitored by doctors, and it's not just like do whatever you want. There's some kind of like at least monitoring. But the idea was like, which I don't think is a crazy one, that since they're so prevalent in sports, like why not just create a new type of sport where we allow performance enhancing drugs? And as a huge fan of like cycling and endurance sports, the drugs have been a part of the sport for a long time, right? And it's a really interesting question. I think it's really easy to like as a casual observer just say like, oh, this is really stupid. They should not have drugs in sports and it's retarded. But like the reality is that it's much more complicated than that. And I'll give you a good example. Like certain things are allowed in cycling, like an altitude training camp. So you're allowed to go and change your physiology through like what we would call like a natural method. You could go and like camp high up in a mountain where the air is thinner, and it'll change your physiology. It'll make you produce or process oxygen faster, and you'll perform better in sport, right? So that's legal. So it's also legal to perhaps have some kind of like a reduced oxygen tent. So you can like be on the ground and then do things around how you sleep in order to change your physiology and improve your performance, right? So like, is that like a drug or is it not a drug, right? I think there's a lot of there's all these edge cases out there that start to make the whole thing really complex. There's people that like get prescribed drugs because they need them for certain types of like medical issues, and so they have to allow for that. The drugs are really difficult to detect, so they create all kinds of measures, and the measures don't necessarily measure things correctly because different people's physiology has wildly different measurements. So the whole thing is really complicated. That's why, like, at a high level, I wouldn't go as far as say like I support the enhanced games concept, but I thought it was a really interesting test, and I was really curious to see what happened. And I think it goes along the lines of what you're saying, is that what we know ultimately is that the drugs affect people differently as well. And the result of the games is fascinating because, like, there were athletes who, at least they say, were not on any performance-enhancing drugs, and they won the competitions, which is, like, not what I thought the outcome most people expected from this. Right. They thought for sure, like, these guys are going to be all roided up, and they're going to, like, just break all the records. And it isn't what happened at all. Very few world records were broken. In fact, I was reading today that, like, they put up a $10 million prize for anyone in the next one that breaks Usain Bolt's 2009 world record in the 100-meter sprint, which is just, there's so much to talk about there, dude. Like, that record has stood for that long. Like, it's crazy.
It is crazy.
Even if he's on drugs, which I don't believe he is, he's that much more talented than athletes who take drugs. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so, like, to your point, yes, there is variability with athletes' performance, regardless of, you know, if they take performance-enhancing drugs or not. But okay, question back to you, right? Maybe that's not the entire point. The fun fact of Peter Thiel investing into this sport or this enhancement.
Whole other conversation, right?
It's a whole other conversation, but maybe that's where the interesting part is.
Okay.
Let me actually address on the actual enhancement. Very interesting. I do think that I was talking to a friend, Alex, about this as well. I do think that's going to be how we perceive sports in the future, where athletes are already taking performance-enhancing drugs. It's a cat-and-mouse game. We know this. We know this. Putting this into the spotlight will just make it more exciting to watch.
Do you agree? Is that what you think?
I do think that's what I think. I think more people will be able to tune in, and they will essentially get a better show. I do believe this. However, the second order effect is, I think, like, the whole point of creating this enhancement game is to break the monopoly that IOC has on what they call legitimate sport. Because if Peter Thiel's whole entire thesis is all about monopolies, so he's just going out there trying to identify monopolies and just investing in counter monopolies. I think that's, like, his whole entire investment thesis.
A super interesting angle. I hadn't thought about that specifically. I agree. So I don't see how over, like, the next generation that it remains the way it is. It's meaning
that's that, like, right. That's right. That, he's, like, basically timing the market.
I think he's. Okay. I think he's correct that, like, some form of, like, acceptance of performance-enhancing drugs is inevitable in sports.
Yeah.
That's why I described the altitude 100%. Tent, and 100%. Then you can take the altitude mass. Like, the lines are so blurred now anyway.
Exactly.
It's hard to understand, like, where do you draw the line? That's why I look at it and go, like, okay, let them be medically supervised, and I want them to all be safe.
Of course.
I want them to be healthy. But, of course. Like, dude, competing at that level is not healthy. Like, it's not good.
The entire premise is already kind of...
Cycling is the best example, because the sport's been around a really long time. It's very old. And, like, the intent, when they set up a lot of these races, they were designed to be as hard as possible. Like, that sport is not designed to be good for you. Like, racing in the Tour de France for 28 days straight, doing, like, a marathon on a bicycle every day is not great for your body.
So, okay. So, question, right? So, right now, what we're arguing is about taking enhancement drugs. Right. In the very near future, maybe in like 20, 30 years future, do you think enhancement games will be, cyber humans where?
Oh, yeah, I mean, that's right. Of course.
So then the duopoly would be enhancement, which includes, let's say, drug perform enhancement
Dude,
drugs
there
plus
the Blade
cyber
Runner,
games.
that guy was called Blade Runner. He was missing the feet and he competed. I don't remember if it was like.
So maybe this is just the remarketing of like Paralympics, right? Because where technology now is like Paralympics, like the Blade Runner now, he actually runs better than real athletes.
Exactly. I'm all for innovation and technological change. And I also believe they're inevitable is a really important aspect of all this stuff. Like, I don't believe that they could be completely like they, I think they're I think I like the term, they're inevitable. And I think that like this is going to change and it's going to transform sport. And I think we need to find a way to embrace it. Like, I don't I, was the
Well,
enhanced games
or
perfect? Like, it's not perfect,
right.
but I do agree that like some form of this is what it's all going to evolve to. And I think the existing systems are not very good. There's a lot of corruption. So here's another example. The Olympics was set up in a time when like there wasn't a lot of like immigration. Like, you're supposed to build these countries competing with each
Right.
other.
It's
And like
borders.
now, right, the sovereignty of borders was very different than today, where like now countries can just go and like hire a bunch of athletes from another country and give them passports, and now
Very
their
true.
country is winning. So there's a whole bunch of issues like that that make the Olympics and a lot of the way those global sports are set up very difficult to like, or they just need to evolve with the entire world. Like, it's not just technology, there's just sovereignty, there's just ways we view things and things that are happening that are very different than they used to be.
Yeah, exactly. Counterpoint or this duopoly forming in the next 10 years, I think this is going to be big.
Yeah, I something's gonna happen. I think it's I don't know exactly what'll play. Like, I don't know if it'll be the enhanced games or the ones that like this league succeeds, maybe. But something will change. Also, look, putting up $10 million or something to win a track and field event is a massive. I actually don't know if people understand how big of an incentive that is. Because like those sports don't the participants don't earn a lot. Track and field, like the prize to win the Tour de France is like $1 million. You have to split with the entire team. This is not like
I did not
American
know them.
football or American basketball level contracts, right?
Or
Like,
baseball.
these nerdy Olympic sports don't have huge amounts of money in those systems. So $10 million for a sprinter to win that is enough, I think, to attract professionals who maybe don't want to be part of the enhanced games. Because like if they do that, they might not be allowed back in the Olympics. There's a whole bunch of issues, right?
Correct, correct,
And
correct.
so like $10 million, that might be enough to get some people who could actually win that record. So there's a lot of play here.
There's a lot of play. There's some moral questions behind it. I think we'll watch it how it unfolds for the next year or so.
Moral questions. Okay, let's move on to this Vatican AI summit.
Yes,
Since we're
okay.
talking about the
The
morality of
morality of things.
AI, yeah, and take us through this one.
Yeah, so the Vatican, the leader of the Catholic everywhere, the billion plus Catholics on this planet, has remained fairly silent about artificial intelligence until this week, specifically about the moral status of AI making decisions for humans. That's the core of this newly published piece of writing by the Vatican, backed by the Pope. So the Vatican has made previously two statements about AI on the more generic level, on the more generic level, as in the first one was just defining what AI was, and the second one was just kind of walking people through how to approach AI. This one was specifically about the morality of AI, and it named something called algorithmic governance as a category of concern and of interest by the church. And so the church is going to start regulating AI in its own ways and kind of propagating to its
Wait,
own.
what are they going to regulate regarding AI? I didn't catch that part, actually.
So it's creating a regulatory framework on cases where human decisions or human lives are affected by AI. So like if you're a devout Catholic and you're now questioning whether if you want to allow AI into your life, maybe like to affect your relationship with God, now you have a piece of writing to fall back on.
Dude, the Vatican's going to start regulating AI as well?
Of course.
Everyone's getting in on it. Him and Bernie and the EU, they're all going to regulate AI now. Hilarious.
So like this is pretty interesting, right? And it may or may not be related to how Sam Altman and Amit Oz walking back on AI is going to take over all of humans' jobs. Seems fairly coincidental.
I think this new Pope is kind of cool. He had a lot of AI memes. I love those Pope puffy coat things that came out.
Very forward thinking.
A couple years ago.
Yeah, for sure.
But he's kind of like the cool Pope. So I can kind of relate. I don't really know how this affects me. Is he going to start regulating any of our startups with AI? Because then I care. But other than that, like, I mean, I think it's interesting that the Pope has a perspective on AI. I actually think that they should. I actually think that's actually healthy.
So the question here now is, are they late to the game? You know, like, this is when all three companies, SpaceX,
they're in no rush, man. They've been around for like what, 2,000 years? They're fine.
So maybe they're just right on time.
Have you ever been to Vatican City?
I have.
It is cool.
It is. It's like a country within a country.
Now you got me all excited. There should be like Vatican LLM.
Yeah. So the next stage is basically, that's exactly it.
Like it should get trained
country
on.
Country level.
Yeah,
country
it should level. Get trained. Actually, I guess I hadn't like thought that deeply about this. That's the obvious next step if I was the Pope is like, I want an LLM that embodies all of my values and is trained on all of my writings
Thinkings.
And materials. Like they have a lot, they have archives, they have all kinds of like information, things that they publish. Like, why not have Pope LLM and like have AI that meets like it's like meets all of our like culture like this. I know this gets really into like the whole sovereign AI and all that.
Sovereign
stuff.
AI, that's the word. Yeah,
yeah. It's an interesting category. You know, Jensen was talking a lot about this in the beginning that you haven't really heard much on that in a while, but I do think it's really important. And you know. This Pope, he's cool.
Agreed.
Okay.
Shall we move on?
Yeah. Okay. This is Rick Rubin was on David Senra's podcast, and I'm a big fan of the Founders podcast. I used to listen to lots of them on my runs and rides. There's some great episodes that are about people that like are not famous. I heard an episode of one of his podcasts, but a guy that survived like prison camps in World War II and even survived the atomic bomb attack on Japan. It was insane. Anyway, Rick Rubin was featured in a recent one. And for those who don't know, we thought it was important actually to like just provide some background for all the people out there who aren't familiar with Rick Rubin. Like obviously I'm intimately familiar with him. He's been very influential in my life. I remember all the way back in the 80s when him and Russell Simmons started Def Jam Records from their dorm room in NYU in New York City and put out all of these incredible albums from hip hop artists like Run DMC and LL Cool J. And Rick Rubin was involved in producing like all of those incredible records. And you probably don't know this, but like he eventually left Def Jam because he was interested in producing like rock records. And I think he produced the first Slayer album. So like death metal album on Def Jam. The first Slayer album is like, was a Def Jam release. And so Rick Rubin went on to just do more production and work in Hollywood. And Russell Simmons went down the path of becoming like this, like very prominent person in the hip hop world, had a clothing line. an advertising agency at one point. I remember he was like big in New York when I was a kid. Like he was everywhere. He was a big deal. It was really cool. And then, you know, Rick Rubin went to LA and now he's become, what'd you call him? The king of vibes. How would we describe Rick Rubin today?
He is the face of vibe today. So there's a culture of vibe coding where instead of kind of scrutinizing over every single line of code, you just let the LLM do its work. You may or may not read the code and you just accept the outcome as it gets created by the LLM.
I mean,
very, very cool concept.
Yeah, he's kind of the vibe marketing guru, perhaps.
Yes.
It is kind of hard.
Anything to, vibe.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to describe exactly like why he seems to be having a moment right now. I guess maybe it ties in this way is like there's a recognition in the technology space that taste matters.
Yes.
And I think a lot of
correct.
People, yeah, I think a lot of people look at Rick Rubin as a guy who like his entire career has been about somehow using that and being able to either predict or even force his own tastes onto the public. So I think that's why people really like hearing his thoughts about it. You know, I don't know if he's always right, but I'm curious to hear, like, what do you think about like Rick Rubin's approach?
So I listened to all of his podcasts, a few other as well. Just the way that he describes his process really resonates with what I'm hoping to achieve as well. So one thing that he said about producing a hit song or just mm-hmm. producing any song, mm-hmm. there's no method to it. He is constantly looking for a moment where a song sounds good for the first time. So they make adjustments over and over and over again until there's a moment where it just sounds good to him. And then after that, it's not about adding or subtracting anymore. It's about fine-tuning it to keep that moment for as long as possible. So like how that translates into building products or coding these days is we're almost doing the exact same thing. We don't know exactly when something becomes usable or tasteful or it will be loved by millions of people. We're always looking for a moment where it just suddenly clicks. And I think everything that he describes is really relevant to how AI systems are being built right now, because AI has no idea or concept of what a good piece of content will look like, what a piece of good code looks like. It's just constantly looking for that moment where things just works. And like we're, as an industry, we're building towards that moment. We're building towards that system where you can train an AI to recognize that.
Yeah.
It's very, very interesting.
I think that's a great description of like Rick Rubin and his approach. I there's so much that resonates with me. I also find a lot of people are so deeply frustrated with like the guru approach, the like no formula
yeah.
approach, the idea that like some things you just kind of have to kind of like roll with it. It's very interesting.
So like one thing he also said is that there's no right way of doing things. There's no one right way of doing things. So his approach of just kind of trusting his instincts or relying on his own personal taste to dictate if something is good or not. There's also a complete other side of people who doesn't trust their gut feeling and relies on metrics, stats.
Yeah, this is excellent. Really excellent. Because like I thought a lot about this question, like what makes something cool? What makes something
right.
good? What makes a piece of creative good? What makes a joke funny? So, and where I landed on all of this and what I believe Rick Rubin actually does is he is just super confident about his decisions and his choices, and he's really passionate about it. And I think that is the formula. I actually coach people on this, like, because I've been through a lot of like really large scale rebranding projects, and I'd always would bring up like, well, there's actually been a bunch of them now, like failed branding projects, like the Jaguar one, the Cracker Barrel one. There's also was like the Gap one where they changed the logo for like 30 days and went back to it. And my ultimate analysis of all of those rebrandings is that the reason they failed is the teams that put them out there were not confident enough. Like, if they really, really believed like that Jaguar brand was the right approach, they should have just stuck with it. You know,
I
that's
agree.
A hard, that one's hard, I guess, because like they maybe didn't have the money and the market reaction was really poor. But the market reaction can be poor to things all the time in the beginning. People don't like
100%. Change.
They don't like things that are new and innovative. Slayer was not super cool and popular when they first came out. There were a lot of people that hated rap music when it started. My mother was not a fan of Run DMC. I got in trouble because like I had a Run DMC album at school and people were just like, what the hell is this stuff? So it's controversial, right? But like Rick Rubin shows clearly that like you need to be extremely confident in what you're doing. And that is the key. And I think that really only comes from if you love it. So I do this all the time with jokes. I like to post memes. I like to post jokes. And I think they're funny. And that is literally my test. Like, then you and I, we joke all the time. Like, do we think this is really funny? If we think it's funny, then it's good enough to go out there and like, maybe not everyone gets it.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with that. But yeah. I wouldn't post it if like I didn't think it's funny, but other people perhaps thought it was funny.
Yeah.
That's not the goal for me. And that's why I think like, it's the really important distinction between like, are you doing this like metrics driven, very like quantitative approach? Or are you doing this from this very qualitative, like, I like it, therefore it has value? Like,
exactly.
I think there's like a mix of the two. Like, you know, like I always joke, I love to say this, like, I'm not an ignoramus. Like, I understand that numbers and metrics matter. But I also think that the other side matters too. Like, if I don't believe in it, I'm not passionate about it, I'm not excited about it, if I don't think it's funny, then like, why would I post it? How could I stand behind it? And I think for me, that is like the formula for Rick Rubin. Like, he is just, you could just tell when you talk to him, like, he thought Slayer was an awesome band and had a great, and made a great album. Just like all the other albums that he put out. Not all of them are hits.
Yeah. So that's exactly what he said on the podcast as well. And David Sarah agreed with him, where their process really is just, first of all, do they like it? Second of all, can they find another person, a second person that they respect, like to like whatever they're doing? And if that holds, then they put it out there. So the advice of Rick Rubin for founders or everybody is, you don't need to wait a really long time. If you can just get one or two people to agree with you that something is good, you should just put it out there and let the world decide.
Yeah,
I think that really resonates with.
Well, I forgot. So the person who was the best at this was Steve Jobs, and there's actually lots of examples where Steve Jobs put something out there, and if you were paying attention, people like ruthlessly teased him actually in certain product releases.
For sure.
And Steve, like through the Jedi force field that he has, that he borrows from Rick Rubin, was able to just deflect every negative comment, all the negative
for
energy
sure.
back on everybody and convince everybody he was right. So I remember when the iPad came out and a lot of people made fun of it. Dude, he didn't even acknowledge it. Like, he could care less. And that's why it succeeded. That's why it succeeded. Because Steve just looked at me, he's like, I'm Steve Jobs. I think this is awesome. This is why I think the iPad is the best thing ever on the planet. And like, what do you know? And it worked. And that's what I meant by like having confidence. Like, you have to have an extreme level of confidence. It's very hard. I'm not saying it's easy to do, but that's what it takes. And for me, like, I don't know. That's why I think so many people find Rick Rubin really inspiring.
100%. So love the guy. I think lots of builders in tech should really dig into his philosophy of just put things out there, see what happens.
All right. I got one more thing I want to touch on before we sign off. So I don't know where I stumbled onto this data, but it was a chart that showed the top universities where the undergraduate alumni had raised venture capital. And I looked at it and I was like, what? Like number one, I would have said was Stanford, but it's not Stanford. It's actually the University of California in Berkeley with 1,804
that is wild.
Venture funded startups in the past decade. Stanford comes in two at 1,519. Third is obviously Harvard, 1,355. Then you have the University of Pennsylvania, 1,206. And then rounding it off in fifth place, MIT at 1,019. So two Ivy League universities. What is it? Three from the East Coast and two from the West Coast. What do you think about that, Paul?
That is wild. Why do you think that is?
So there's a couple, as an alumni, and I was also thinking like all the people, like friend of the show, Arjun is a Berkeley graduate. Other people, very important people in my life. I lived in Berkeley for a very long time. I also spent a lot of time as a kid in Berkeley. I love Berkeley. There's just, I don't know why. So I don't know the full answer, but I did look up a very practical reason. Berkeley admits a lot more students than Stanford. So if you do this by per capita, Stanford wears the crown, like for sure. So but it beats it still on like a raw number, which is, I still think, really impressive, right? It's the only one that's not a private institution. It's a public institution, right? MIT, all of those are private schools. They're not public. You know, in Pennsylvania and Harvard are Ivy League schools. So of course, they're great, attract great people, have lots of resources. So my guess is ultimately that for some reason, because of Berkeley's proximity in the Bay Area, all these Nobel laureates and smart people have gone there. It just has an incredible network, and students and former alumni are able to get funded. Didn't Ben Horowitz go there? And the Databricks guys all went there. So there's like a rich history of like incredible companies coming out of Berkeley.
So you think it's just a long institutional kind of build up knowledge?
Yeah, I mean, they have the Lawrence Livermore Center. There's some unique things that are in Berkeley and proximity, right? So you had Stanford, and then you looked it up, right? So HP, they all went to Stanford. HP is like maybe the seminal Silicon Valley innovative technology company, right? So they were like in the area, and Berkeley's always known for doing wild and unique stuff. It's the home of like the free speech movement. There's a bunch of really interesting things have happened there. And they really embraced a lot of counterculture. So the computer science department's always been fantastic. So it's like a history of it. And then that's just permeated, I think, the venture capital world and made it easy for those founders to access capital. They have their own incubator. I mean, every university has one, but Skydeck is really successful. I can't even remember the number. I was working with them and someone told me the number of startups come out every year. My head exploded. Hundreds? I should look it up. I couldn't believe how many startups they graduate from the Berkeley incubator program. Incredible.
Awesome.
All right, that's a nice positive note to end the show on, huh?
It's amazing.
All right, Paul. It's been a pleasure.
This is awesome. See you next week.
All right, take care.
Okay, take care.